made me realize that the sushi chef's job is as much the art of compromise as anything else. If you leave a piece of fish too long, it will develop more flavor, but its texture will degrade. If you eat it too soon, it will have nice texture, but not enough flavor. It is impossible to have perfect sushi. So it's always a compromise, and the best skilled chefs, I think, are the ones who are really good at getting that just right.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Netta Ulaby. This week, Trevor Corson talks about the Zen of fish. The book follows a class at the California Sushi Academy as the students mature from aspiring apprentices into knife-wielding chefs. Corson weaves his almost novelistic account of their experiences together with morsels on the history, culture, and science of sushi. Who knew, for example, that the freshest fish is often not the tastiest? Corson didn't start out to become what he calls a seafood guy. He was on his way toward becoming a professor of East Asian studies when he took a breather from the Far East and academia to work on lobster boats in Maine. That experience spawned his acclaimed 2004 book, The Secret Life of Lobsters, which, as he says, is full of exciting sex and violence under the sea. The Zen of Fish is his follow-up and a move back in the direction of his grad school studies. This reading of The Zen of Fish took place in June 2007 at the Politics and Prose bookstore in Washington, D.C.
A lot of people have been asking me how I chose sushi as the topic for this book. And the short-ish answer is you've already heard some of my background interest in East Asia and the Far East and living in Japan. And I had actually gotten homesick after quite a while of living in Japan. So that was when I went back to the U.S., went to Maine, and started working on lobster fishing boats to do something completely different. I had kind of yanked myself out of academia and went to go be a fisherman, and that led to the first book, The Secret Life of Lobsters. So The Secret Life of Lobsters did very well, much better than I could have expected, and my publisher invited me to write a second book. And so I waltzed into my editor's office in New York and, you know, very full of myself. And, well, what topic shall we consider for my second book? Very interested in East Asia. I speak Chinese and Japanese. How about a book on potential for military conflict with Taiwan and China? How about a book about Buddhist priests in Japan and how much they drink? And I had spent a couple of years living in Buddhist temples in Tokyo. Basically, I was supposed to be doing master's degree research, which I never finished because I was spending too much time drinking single malt scotch with these priests. The problem was I was studying an esoteric sect, so it was all secret. So the only way you could find anything about it was to get drunk with these priests and try to coax them into telling you things. So my editor looks at me very skeptically and says, well, are these things going to be of interest to readers of The Secret Life of Lobsters? Because you do need to bring your readers along with you from your first book to your second one. So I left that meeting completely dejected, thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be this, you know, seafood guy for the rest of my life, you know. And people have been suggesting all kinds of topics for me. You've got to write The Secret Life of Crabs. It's been done. In fact, the book Beautiful Swimmers in 1970-something won a Pulitzer Prize for the book on the, you know, it was a book on the Chesapeake blue crab, and still remains a very bitter point for me because in human history, there's only going to be one Pulitzer Prize ever awarded for a book on crustaceans. And the other guy got it, and he had an 18-year head start or something. You know, and other people were like suggesting The Secret Life of Clams, and, you know, how about a book on nematodes? There are these very interesting underwater worms, and, you know. So on the bus back to Boston after my meeting in New York, my fruitless meeting in New York, I started thinking, seafood, Japan, seafood, Japan, you know. And I mean, any smarter person would have figured it out much more quickly. But by the end of the bus ride, I had thought, aha, I had a eureka moment that said sushi. But the real challenge, once I'd gotten that idea, was how to write about sushi, because it's a foreign topic. I mean, sushi is very popular in the U.S., but it's still a foreign topic. And it's tricky when you take on a foreign subject for an American audience. So I wanted to figure out a way to make this very accessible to American readers. And I stewed around with that for a while. And then I discovered, as you heard, the California Sushi Academy. It's a little school out in Los Angeles attached to a restaurant. And I called them up and tried to figure out what they were doing there. And it turns out that they were training many young chefs, including many young Americans, to become sushi chefs. So I thought, that's interesting. So I went out there early in the summer of 2005 and never left. I stayed practically the whole summer through the entire semester at this California Sushi Academy. It turned out to be the perfect way to write about sushi for an American audience, because here were these young Americans whose stories were a metaphor for how sushi has become American. I mean, we have just completely adopted this meal. It's transformed. It's become American. It's still Japanese at the same time. And they're, you know, what is the authentic sushi experience? And then it was a wonderful way for me to indulge my my interest in marine biology, because here were these people cutting up all these fish every day, you know, and so I could start thinking about these fish and these eels and the seaweed and all this great stuff and sea urchins and their gonads. And, you know, if you know The Secret Life of Lobsters, you know that it's a book that's full of exciting sex and violence under the sea. And so the sushi story was rife with opportunities for that as well. So that ended up becoming the spine of the book, the narrative, the story that tied it all together. And I ended up following Kate, this young woman who was determined to become the sushi chef. And she had terrible time on the way and terrible challenges. And, you know, she really persevered. And eventually, I won't give away the ending, but I mean, eventually she, you know, and she suffered discrimination because she was not only not Asian, but she was a woman. And so there were all kinds of issues there. So there was this wonderful cast of characters that just was sort of a microcosm of the internationalization of sushi, and it was a great opportunity to look at all the different aspects of it. So that was great. And then I came home, and after my time in Los Angeles, and had 37 notebooks, and I looked at them and I said, holy crap, I'm never going to get this book written. And so it was a big slog to get through all that material and cut out what I didn't need and all of that. And the writing process was really a major challenge to get through, because I had set very high standards for myself. I wanted to write a novelistic book that had dialogue and action, but I wasn't going to make anything up. It all had to be stuff I'd actually seen and written down and taken detailed notes about. So, which I think is what the standard should be for journalists, writing this kind of stuff. So it was a huge amount of work. And then I wanted to find out more about the history of sushi and the animals, all the different creatures. And as Barbara mentioned, I was able to find some Japanese books. That this is stuff that has never been, you know, translated into English. Most of us are completely unaware of the history of sushi. A lot of Japanese people don't even know about it. One of the primary books that I used as a resource was a book called, in Japanese, Japanese People Know Nothing About Sushi. So I said, well, neither do Americans. Let's get started. So what I want to share with you briefly, and then I'll take questions, is the extraordinariness, I can't think of a better word, of the fact that the sushi as we know it exists at all. I mean, we take it for granted. It's everywhere now, right? Sushi is everywhere, and we think, oh, well, this has been around, you know, forever in Japan. It's an ancient traditional food, and finally it's come to us, and now it's spread around the globe. The sushi that we know today almost never came into existence at all. And it's just a series of historical accidents that it did. And I want to take you back to 1600 in the old city of Tokyo, which was then called Edo. It was a Wild West atmosphere. The shogun had just moved the capital to this new location to get away and escape the influence of the emperor. And he was building a new city, and he had all these construction workers building this grand new city that was to become the new capital. And all these workers had to eat something, and they loved hot noodles. So everyone would go home at the end of the day of building new castles to eat hot noodles on the street at these little stalls, which was fine for a while. But then in about 50 years after this great construction effort got underway, somebody's hot noodle stand probably tipped over, and some wood nearby caught fire, and the entire city burned down. So there were some talented bureaucrats in those days, we know, because someone came up with the idea of outlawing fire on the street. So no more hot noodle stands as we rebuild the city for the second time. This was sushi's big break. Sushi doesn't have to be cooked. Sushi had existed up until that point in various forms, but it was basically rice that had been pressed with fish and left to sit around for a while to develop a little fermentation, a little tartness, maybe even some vinegar thrown in. Oh, vinegar didn't come later. Came around that time. So suddenly stands selling sushi spread throughout the whole city. And this was the beginning of sushi as we know it today. It was like the McDonald's drive-thru of old Tokyo. Especially in the 1800s, someone came up with this idea of squeezing together a little pack of rice with a slice of fish on top real quick. That didn't happen until like 1820. Someone came up, instead of pressing a bunch of rice in a big box and putting fish on top of it and pressing it with stones and everything and then cutting it into slices like a cake, oh, let's just squeeze it together with our fingers and serve it that way. So that was the invention of modern sushi. And it was literally like samurai on their way home from the bathhouse, construction workers who were finished their day of work, they would stop by and eat sushi at one of these little stands. So that's how it got started, a crude snack food on the street. In Tokyo only. Only Tokyo had this kind of sushi. Then what happened was that Tokyo was destroyed again. 1923, the great Kanto earthquake, close to 100,000 people killed, much of the city devastated, burned to the ground, ruined. They started to rebuild, but then World War II started, and again the city was devastated during World War II by the Allied firebombing raids. Tokyo was just wiped out. Sushi chefs in Tokyo gave up. So forget it. We can't do this anymore. We can't make a living. Most of them went out into the provinces, back to their provincial villages. That was good for sushi in one sense, because it spread the sushi as we know it today, Tokyo-style sushi, around all of Japan for a brief shining moment. But then sushi as we know it today, again, almost died out completely because food became rationed during the war. They ran out of everything. No one had any food anymore. All the fish were rationed. All the rice was rationed. All the restaurants closed. And we have the American occupation authorities, MacArthur and his loyal troops and bureaucrats after World War II, who came up with the idea of having people bring their little ration of rice to a sushi shop so that the sushi shops could reopen. They were trying to restart the Japanese economy, and they thought, aha, we can't let restaurants reopen because all the food's rationed, but we can have people bring their own rice in and have sushi chefs make that into sushi, and that way we can at least start a segment of the restaurant industry going. So this got going in Tokyo at first, and then the Americans sat around and said, well, let's see, sushi is what we see here. So they took Tokyo-style sushi, some nigiri, a few little rolls, and they made a regulation that so much rice could be made into exactly these kinds of sushi, and then they promulgated that regulation throughout the country. So suddenly, the U.S. occupation authorities had said, this is official sushi, Tokyo-style sushi, and all Japanese will eat it, and this is the only food you can eat if you want to go out to a restaurant. So sushi restaurants started to open up after World War II before any other kind of restaurant. And that is why sushi now is spread throughout Japan and has become ubiquitous in Japan. It has become, Tokyo-style sushi has become the sushi. There are still regional varieties, but it is the sushi. And that set the stage, of course, for sushi to spread around the rest of the globe, which is a whole other story we can talk about if you'd like. But I wanted to give you that background. I think maybe just open it up to questions now if any of you have specific things that you would like me to talk about that have to do with sushi or eating sushi. And on that topic, I'll also mention that I have my handy How to Eat Sushi postcard available here at the desk. So if you, I'd love to have you pick up a copy of the book and sign it for you. And I hope you'll also take a few of these postcards with you to give to your friends who have been dying to know proper sushi bar etiquette. So, does anyone have any sushi questions? Yes.
How could this have developed in the 1600s and people not have died of food poisoning?
Good questions. Okay, well, the first story was about working in a sushi bar and encountering Moonies, the religious group from Korea. And the second question was, if people had sushi in the 1600s and no refrigerators, how come they didn't all die? Unfortunately, they're not here to tell us, so we will never know. No, the Mooney connection to sushi is a very interesting one. One of the Reverend Sun Young Moon decided to make fish. He saw the demand, I think, as sushi was spreading around the world, and particularly into the U.S. And he saw the demand for it, and he decided to make a business venture of fish from ocean to restaurant. And so they own a number of fishing vessels. They own and run a sushi-grade fish distribution network throughout the country. Large, large amounts of the sushi fish that we get are distributed through their network, caught and distributed through their network. They have done a wonderful job, in fact, of ingratiating themselves in places like Gloucester, Massachusetts, where you can imagine no place being more hostile to outsiders like them. And they've been very friendly and set up business in those kinds of places to get into the local fish networks. And there was an interesting article, I believe it was in the Chicago Tribune in the past 6 months or so, about that details all of that. You could probably find that on the internet. So that's a short answer to your question. There are more details, but yeah, they are a major player in the sushi fish purveyor business. The second question: why didn't people die when they ate raw fish? Well, one of the most interesting things I learned in researching this book, and one of the most surprising things, was that traditionally sushi is not supposed to be raw. Traditional sushi chefs generally did something to all of the fish that they served. And of course, one of the reasons was that they had no refrigeration. And one of the most common things was the use of salt and vinegar to pickle fish slightly. And so much so that the word in Japanese for sushi, a word in Japanese that was frequently used to describe sushi shops was tsukeba, which means a pickling place. Because they used so much salt and vinegar on their fish. This is very interesting. And if you go to a sushi bar today, probably a higher scale, more traditional sushi bar, and for instance order mackerel, that sushi will be pickled. The chef will have done a very subtle job on that fish over the previous day or two, with vinegar and salting it and marinating it in vinegar, and that's the traditional way to do it. And this gets into the biology of fish, and this was fascinating to learn and write about in the book. Fish flesh is actually, you don't actually want to be eating perfectly fresh fish at all. So everybody's like, oh, you got to go to the sushi bar, it has the freshest fish. You really don't want the freshest fish. I mean, by the time a fish gets to a sushi bar, it's not quite fresh, no matter where it is, unless it's right out the edge of the ocean. But if it is at the end, there are sushi places, you know, some of these fancy places have a fish tank, and they have live fish swimming in, and they'll try to impress you by pulling out a live fish and chopping its head off and serving it right there while it's still wiggling. That chef is not doing you any favors, because that fish is not going to taste like anything. It takes time for the flesh, the proteins in the flesh, to degrade and break down into the molecules that create flavor. And pickling is a great way to not cook the fish, because a lot of fish, if you cook them, all the degradation happens too fast, and all those flavor molecules bind with others and become compounds that aren't flavorful. That's why if you cook a fish too much, you ruin it instantly, because it'll become rubbery and lose flavor. So pickling is actually an ideal way to preserve a fish for just long enough for that all those flavor compounds to reach a peak and become very, very tasty. Because the pickling will prevent bacteria from eating away at the fish in that time, so it doesn't go bad, but it will allow the flavor molecules to develop. And in Kyoto, in the old city of Kyoto, from the seaside to Kyoto, there was a path, and runners would carry mackerel in baskets on their back overnight. So the fish would be caught during the day, landed in the afternoon, the runners would salt them, pick them up, and run them overnight into Kyoto, so they would arrive the next morning exactly between 12 and 24 hours after they were killed, and that was the perfect amount of time for those mackerel to come to the peak of their flavor development in the flesh, and then they were eaten right then. So a lot of these fish were preserved using pickling techniques that prevented bacteria from spoiling the fish. And a lot of other ingredients were boiled, blanched, cooked lightly in traditional sushi before the age of refrigeration. And there are still some sushi aficionados out there who don't consider it real Tokyo-style sushi unless the chef has done something to the fish, not left it completely raw. So that was a very surprising thing to discover. And it made me realize that the sushi chef's job is as much the art of compromise as anything else. If you leave a piece of fish too long, it will develop more flavor, but its texture will degrade. If you eat it too soon, it will have nice texture, but not enough flavor. It is impossible to have perfect sushi. So it's always a compromise, and the best skilled chefs, I think, are the ones who are really good at getting that just right. Another question?
When you're talking about this pickling process, it made me think of ceviche, the great Latin American dish, which is almost sort of the national dish of a lot of countries, including Peru. And I'm just wondering, is there any connection between sushi and ceviche? I mean, did the Japanese who went to Peru bring it? Or I don't know the origin of ceviche.
I don't know the origin of ceviche either. And there is a strong connection between Japan and Peru. That's a great question. I do know that Nobu, the famous chef Nobu Matsuhisa, worked in Peru, I believe, for quite a few years. And he was one of the ones who pioneered sort of fusion sushi that combines ceviche and sushi in the U.S. And that's become a big trend now. He was ridiculed for it by traditional sushi chefs where he was working at first when he started doing that. But now he's the one having the last laugh. What has he got, 5 or 6, you know, grand restaurants around the world, Rochelle?
Had it taken off in the West?
No. Sushi was virtually unknown at that point, yeah, in the West. Sushi did not appear in the U.S., Tokyo-style sushi did not appear in the U.S. until mid-1960s, I believe it is. And it was brought here by a Japanese businessman who was trying to find a product that he could sell in the U.S. And he hadn't even considered sushi because he considered it far too disgusting for Americans. They would never eat it. So instead, he was attempting to import snake meat, chocolate-covered ants. Sushi was the last resort when those failed. Yeah.
When I was in Japan a couple of years ago, for about a week, I made a point to try to go to sushi restaurants where I was the only round eye.
Mm-hmm.
And was also watching carefully how the locals ate. And it bore little resemblance to what you described.
So tell me, what did you see?
They ate like we ate. They had pieces of sushi too big to eat in one piece. Some people put ginger in their soy sauce. Some did not. Apparently random distribution of rice down or rice up in the soy sauce. And there often was wasabi on the tray. And not just me. I was watching what other people were served because I recognized the possibility that the Japanese chefs were trying to meet my expectations.
Right, their norms. Sure. Yeah. Well, the thing that's interesting is that in Japan, there is also a whole range of sushi knowledge.
I should say I was only in Tokyo.
The thing that's happened, and when was this?
Around Labor Day 2005.
Oh, so relatively recently. Yeah. So one of the things that's happened in Japan is that sushi has been redemocratized. And if you had looked, you know, probably 20 years ago, or especially in the 80s, sushi was almost uniformly the domain of businessmen on corporate expense accounts.
It was, in fact, the other time I was in Tokyo, and my brother who worked there and is fluent chose not to take me to sushi.
Because it was too expensive, maybe. Yeah, and it was interesting. I looked at surveys of there was one survey in particular of Japanese housewives that they interviewed them about their sushi eating habits, and most of them were absolutely terrified of going to a sushi bar because they had no idea what to do. They didn't know how to eat sushi. They didn't know how to order it. They were afraid of making a mistake. And I have had the same experience when I've talked to just average Japanese friends, fellow students of mine or whatever, when I was living in Japan. Also, you know, I would say I had gone to eat sushi at a sushi bar, and they, oh my God, that was brave of you. I've never done that. So in the over the past few decades, one of the things that's happened is that cheaper sushi places and also these conveyor belt sushi places, which you've probably heard about, have opened up. And those are very similar, in a sense, to our average sushi places because a lot of those people don't have a lot of experience eating traditional sushi with the etiquette or anything like that, just as we don't. And I know what you're saying. You know, I've been to sushi places in Japan where people do all kinds of things with their sushi. In fact, there's a wonderful video circulating on the internet right now. Somebody, an American tourist, went to a conveyor belt sushi place, which is like a belt going around the sushi bar with little pieces of sushi on plates. And they had the idea of sticking their video camera on the conveyor belt. So you get this wonderful kind of slice of life of all these different Japanese people sitting at the sushi bar eating, and some of them, you know, are completely oblivious to the camera going by. Some are picking their teeth, and some are eating with chopsticks, whatever. You know, you name it, big piece of sushi. So my experience is that when I have been to the higher end, small, hard to find neighborhood sushi bars, and it's always because I've been taken there by some Japanese person. I've never been able to find these places on my own. They don't even have signs. I mean, you have to know exactly where they are. And when you go in there, the servings are always very small, and these are people who eat sushi frequently at this level, and you know, generally I've seen them eating with their fingers because they don't want because the sushi is smaller and they don't want it to fall apart. And I think the same thing has happened in Japan that's happened here, which is this like cult of big portions. It's become this like bargain thing, you know, and the bigger sushi. You know, I tell people, well, you're supposed to eat your sushi in one bite, and they say, you're crazy. You know, have you seen the sushi that I get served? And they're right, because you can't eat it in one bite because they're trying to outdo the sushi place next door, you know, with bigger portions, sort of American style. The thing that's interesting about this that I wanted to say was that in a way, it's bringing sushi back to its roots in Japan, where it was this fast street food and fast food. It's very democratic, and sushi during the post-war years became so elaborate and so fancy and so refined that it got away from that. And so now you've got a lot more average people in Japan eating sushi, too, any which way they want to. So that's a great question. Yeah.
Trevor, just a quick question. What's the genesis of the sushi roll? How did we go from nigiri to what now seems to be the most prevalent
right.
form of sushi?
Right. Rolls, American sushi is all about the roll. We have all manner of extraordinary rolls with fancy names. And, you know, the Thanksgiving roll with turkey and cranberry sauce and, you know, you name it. Philadelphia roll with smoked salmon and cream cheese. And so, these are all American inventions. Sushi rolls do exist in Japan, but in a very limited sense. Traditional sushi bars will usually serve a very narrow, thin roll with the seaweed on the outside, with usually just one ingredient, and that might be cucumber or tuna or sometimes a few other vegetables. And those are pretty much the only rolls generally served, and they're usually an afterthought. They're usually sort of served at the end of the meal just to make sure you go home full or something like that. And there's one other kind of big roll that's made in Japan for picnics and that kind of thing. That has a lot of ingredients. But the inside-out roll seems to have been invented in Los Angeles, a sort of American trick to get Americans to eat sushi, because chefs realized that the Americans didn't like the idea of eating seaweed. And so they put the seaweed on the inside and hid it when they rolled it up. So the rice was on the outside, so you didn't know there was seaweed in there. And Americans really latched on to, like, the California roll, and they didn't have to think about seaweed, out of sight, out of mind. The first recipe, though, for a sushi roll in Japan, actually, I found, is the same year of the American Revolution, 1776. And you all have seen those. This is just a little aside on sushi rolls. You've seen those mats, right? The bamboo mats used for making sushi rolls. They look like little window blinds. That's what everybody says. They look like little window blinds. Well, this recipe in 1776 states simply, take a window blind. And then they don't recommend using seaweed. They say take the skin of a poisonous blowfish, spread it on the window blind, cover it with rice, put fish inside, and roll it up. And that apparently was the first sushi roll. I just found that was fascinating. So when you see those little miniature window blinds, that's exactly what they are. Yeah.
Trevor, I don't want to blow it out of proportion if it wasn't a big book for you before you started your crustacean writing voyage. But since you mentioned Beautiful Swimmers, that was one of the first nonfiction books that I ever read that read like fiction in a sense. And I'm wondering, did you read it before you started writing both your books? Did it have a big impact? And just could you talk about the book?
Yeah. I did read Beautiful Swimmers while I was working on the lobster story. And it's a beautiful book. It's beautifully done. He's a good customer of yours. It was actually great. Recently, I gave a talk on lobsters at the local Audubon Society, and I got to see the room where he had written the book, William Warner, where he had actually written the book, which was really neat. I did love the book. I think I try to write narrative. I try to have a story that goes through the whole book. And Beautiful Swimmer is a little bit different. It was more kind of touching on a bunch of different scenes in a way. And so I think it wasn't necessarily a model per se for writing my lobster book, but in the sense that he covered the biology and behavior of the animals and the lives of the fishermen and all that sort of thing, it was an inspiration, definitely. Do we have time for a couple more questions? Yeah.
I've always heard that parasites are a big problem.
What defines sushi grade? I've got some great parasite scenes in the book. Yeah, really gripping. Really gripping. Yeah, parasites are a wonderful topic. I even mentioned there's actually I found out there's a parasite museum in Tokyo. And I had something on my website about this, and someone added a comment that said this makes lutefisk sound is that how you pronounce it? Sound appetizing. But the parasites are an issue. Salmon, all the salmon you eat in sushi has been deep frozen for at least 72 hours, depends on the temperature and stuff, because those are full of worms, and you would not be eating them if they weren't being frozen regularly. I mean, they all are, because none of us are getting sick from eating salmon sushi. In the Parasite Museum in Tokyo, there is a wonderful worm from a man who ate a freshwater trout sushi, and it was extracted from him later, and it's 30 feet long. I'm not trying to scare anybody away from sushi. I mean, it's the sushi chef, part of the sushi chef technique is, you know, preventing that kind of thing from happening. The pickling helps, and being aware of the fish and all that. The second question was about sushi-grade fish and what makes sushi-grade fish. Well, at this point, the whole distribution system for fish that provides fish for sushi is really quite independent of the distribution system that provides fish for supermarkets. The standards are much, much higher. The fish are either preserved very carefully at the temperatures necessary to prevent any kind of spoilage. A lot of the tuna you're getting has been instantly hyper deep frozen in liquid nitrogen aboard the fishing vessel at -70 degrees, so fast that the water and the flesh doesn't even have time to crystallize. It's amazing technology they have now. So the fish are completely different than the fish that show up in the supermarket in terms of how they're handled and how quickly they're moved through the system. And this has become a global trade. You know, I mean, I had drinks with a tuna distributor in New York last weekend who was talking about his work, and it's amazing. I mean, the air freight and the transit times and the level of attention paid to these fish, you know, when they're fetching the kind of prices they do at the sushi bar, they can afford to be treated that way. So I think that's the real difference.
Sushi keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So there's more and more that we're trying all these different kinds of fish and
right.
shellfish.
Right.
Different types of clams and whatnot. What is your opinion on where this is going?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I try to address that in the book as I talk about each of the different kind of fish. What are the ecological and environmental issues with the different fish? I mean, not in a preachy way. I don't really have an agenda. I just want people to have the information available to them to think about it. And I guess I'll answer the question by saying that one of the most interesting things I learned was that the fish that we lionize today, the tuna, you know, which is considered the pinnacle of sushi. And which is the fish that's most in trouble. You know, bluefin tuna are just in big, big trouble. And, you know, I mean, I personally generally don't eat bluefin tuna sushi anymore at all just because I think the cost is too high environmentally. But what I discovered was that these fish were considered garbage fish decades and decades ago. The Japanese would never eat tuna. In the 1800s, if you tried to serve someone tuna sushi, they would spit on you and, you know, walk out in disgust, because these bloody fatty fish were not considered worth eating. And the pinnacle of sushi were the kings of Japanese sushi for many, many decades were these light lean fish like flounders and snapper, and these have much subtler flavors, which were greatly appreciated by sushi aficionados. A lot of those fish have overfishing issues too, but not to the extent of tuna, and there are a lot of more options. And a lot of, there's a lot of good aquaculture being done. There's bad aquaculture being done too, which I also talk about. But it's just interesting that this cult of the fatty, melt-in-your-mouth flavor that we associate with the ultimate of sushi is a kind of a new thing, and it's kind of a, it's slightly Americanized. The Japanese didn't start eating red fatty meats until after World War II from Western influence. So I encourage people a little bit just to consider the idea that there are other options out there, other flavors, more subtle things that you can eat, other choices you can make that are both, from a gastronomic point of view, more authentic in a way. I mean, I don't want to set rules for authenticity, but in a way, they're more traditional, and you could be making a better environmental choice at the same time.
After having traveled for so long, what do you now think about the sushi scene in Washington?
I think we had the most sort of traditional and interesting experience at Sushi Taro on 17th and P, which is, you know, an old family, Japanese family-run place that's been there forever. But it takes some work to get that. You've got to get to know the chef and, you know, get them to understand where you're coming from and what your level of understanding is and appreciation is. So my real answer to that question is not even a specific sushi town or anything, because the distribution of fish has become so... I mean, this tuna distributor I was talking to the other day, he said, you know, I can't get my chefs in Manhattan the tuna I want to be getting them, because all the good tuna is going to Kansas City now. So so that's an answer to your question in a way. I think the real answer to the question is that, to me, sushi is as much about the social experience and the interaction with the chef and getting to know the chef and having them and putting your trust in them and letting them decide for you what, and the thing is that the chef always has a range of different qualities of fish at his disposal, and he's always going to give the better cuts of fish to the people he knows well, who he knows are regular customers who keep coming back over and over again, and who've made it clear that they're serious about cuisine and getting to know and understand it. So my advice, which is what the advice of many of the sushi people in LA that I got to know when I was researching the book, was just find a local sushi bar that you feel comfortable with and go frequently. And don't pick the most expensive place that's going to have the best fish, because you're not going to be able to go there very often. And go frequently and get to know the chef and ask them questions and develop a rapport and see what happens. So that would be my answer to that. Well, thank you all so much for coming tonight. It's been great having you here.
For more readings like this one, visit npr.org/booktour. Thanks for listening.